Good morning, my dear brothers and sisters. Let's begin by singing hymn number 229, hymn 229. Great Shepherd of your people, hear your presence now display. As you have gathered us for prayer, so give us hearts to pray. Hymn 229. Before the exhortation, let us sing hymn 217, hymn 217. Thy way, not mine, O Lord, however dark it be, lead me by thine own hand, choose out the path for me. Hymn 217.
Thank you.
Now it's with much pleasure that I call on Brother Alan to exhort us this morning.
Well, my dear brethren and sisters, there are times in our lives when we are very conscious of the relentless and unstoppable passing of the hours. Unlike the occasions when we are perhaps enjoying ourselves so much or intensely wrapped up in some activity when time doesn't seem to exist, I'm sure we can all think of those days when every passing hour brings us closer to some event that we dread, or perhaps that is just very significant for us at that particular time. Maybe we have an interview coming up, or an examination, when the weeks of preparation begin to give way to just those few days before the exam, and we just want to get the ordeal over and done with. Maybe we have a difficult situation to deal with at work, or perhaps we have a hospital appointment. And so the day breaks. We get to lunchtime, and then an hour before, and then 10 minutes before, until finally the moment comes. And there are countless examples like this in our personal and our business lives, which all of us face from time to time. And it struck me that this chapter that we have read together in Luke this morning makes many passing references to the passage of time. It describes some of the most difficult hours that any man has ever lived through, with the Lord Jesus suffering the additional stress that he knew that there was going to be no relief, no possibility of a pleasant surprise, nothing at all to smooth the way. And at the end, no friends to share it with either. He was, without any doubt, going to suffer a horrible death. Now the feast of unleavened bread drew nigh. The time in the calendar was fixed, and it was a notable event in the annual calendar for many people. Most, if not all, understood what the Passover was and what it signified. But for Jesus, this particular Passover carried a special meaning. He himself was the special Passover lamb that would be offered this year, an offering never to be repeated. For him, it was to be a time when he would carry the responsibility of offering himself as a sacrifice which could save the world. But if he didn't reach that standard that he had been set by his Father, the world would be plunged into eternal oblivion. Around the Lord, there was a small company of men who had followed him for 3 years as his devoted companions, and women also who had followed him too. But they had yet to fully appreciate the magnitude of what was going on. And yet despite that, Jesus loved them for their own sakes. And he loved them because they were the embryo of the many followers who were yet to come, those who yet were to believe in Jesus in subsequent generations. And those disciples were on the verge of becoming apostles, ones sent. And they would be given the responsibility to call others to future positions in the truth. Those disciples had been chosen individually by Jesus, and never did Jesus regret the choice. As this feast of Passover drew nigh, the disciples knew that it was a special occasion, even more than usual. Jesus was preparing to speak to them more profoundly than he had ever done before, and to lay bare their need for spiritual nourishment even as they ate the Passover lamb on the table. Jesus knew that they would need to ask questions, that they would need reassurance, before they also would find themselves alone with their own feelings and their own consciences. And Judas, the betrayer, knew that the moment had come for him as well. He could no longer hesitate whether to go ahead with something that he'd always been planning and had now decided he would do. And so as the preparations for that Passover were being made, he went to the chief priests and set in train a short series of events that were to reveal him as the betrayer. He was motivated by greed, but possibly it was with an uncomfortable feeling inside him that he went his way to do what he'd planned. By verse 7, we have left behind the words drew nigh, and we read, "Then came the day of unleavened bread, when the Passover must be killed." Peter and John were sent on a mission to make the necessary preparations in compliance with Jesus' command. And they responded with the inevitable question, quite reasonably, where? Instead of giving them an address, Jesus gave them a sign, the unusual sign of a man bearing a pitcher of water. Not something you'd expect to see a man doing, so it would be quite easily recognisable. The moment hadn't quite come for the betrayal to be played out, so the risk was removed by not revealing exactly where Jesus would be at that stage, but simply introducing another character who would take them straight to the room. And here, brethren and sisters, we have another line of thought to add to the one we've already introduced. We've already thought about the steady passage of the hours, totally within the control of the Father, filled with tense expectancy. But now, secondly, we think about something else. We think about the people that were involved in this drama. In fact, we have two selections of people. On the one hand, we have a group of ordinary and sometimes very humble people who represent humanity in all its aspects of needs and temperament. And on the other, we have the influential, the ambitious and the strong. And this latter category, such as the high priests and the rulers of the Jews, they do indeed have a part to play, but once that part is played, we have no further interest in them. We go back to the first category, the ordinary people. So drawing these two lines of thought together, we can see how God is calling for himself a people, mostly from the ordinary folk, to be his children. And the somber ticking of the clock means a great deal to them. They are aware of some of the most momentous events in the history of the world, while for everyone else, life just goes on. Though they may be busy following the cares and interests which fill their lives, the disciples know that they have a real work to do, something to look forward to, and they're aware that their time and their opportunities as they wait for that future are limited. Each day brings for them an opportunity and a duty to devote themselves to the service of their Lord, submitting themselves to God's will, because they know that this world is passing away and they too are only human. When the hour was come, And now we are into the details of the actual day. Jesus sat down with the apostles and proceeded to say extraordinary things to them. He told them that he was going to suffer. Not just to suffer, but experience agony. He was going to be betrayed. He was going to be abused. And he was going to die. But despite that, he was going to use this occasion in the upper room to show them what loyalty meant, what love meant, and what resurrection meant too. And this was the occasion when he taught them the lesson of humility, when he washed their feet. And he summed up all these aspects in one short sentence: I will not any more eat of this Passover until it be fulfilled in the kingdom of God. And then he broke the bread and said it was to remind them of his body, which was to be given for them. It was followed by the cup of wine, which is the New Testament, the new covenant in his blood. And this they were to do regularly afterwards in remembrance of Jesus. Probably those men felt as if they needed all night to take in what Jesus was telling them and to continue to feel the love and the care that the Lord had for them. And Jesus too would have felt the warmth and the comfort of the men who were with him, who'd been with him for those 3 years. But the clock was ticking. It was now time for Judas to go and complete what he had arranged to do. He would have rejoined the disciples once his plan had been made, having no doubt been told where the room was where Jesus was going to celebrate the Passover. He'd sat in on that meal with Jesus and the others, but now he could stay there no longer. Time for him was up. And in John's parallel record, we read that Jesus said to him, "That thou doest, do quickly." And he went. Judas is the all-time example of a betrayer, but not the other disciples. It stirred up within them an anxiety that they too might be guilty of such a thing, but the thought was beyond them. And so Peter in particular sought every assurance that he was truly a disciple. So he wanted not just his feet to be washed, but his head as well. He said he was ready to go to prison and to death. Indeed, he was soon to brandish a sword in defence of his master. And so as they sat round that table in the upper room, Jesus gave them a glimpse of the future. For a moment, they could forget the events which would soon take place just a few hours ahead of them, and he projected their minds far into the future. "I appoint unto you a kingdom, as my Father hath appointed unto me, that ye may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." The Lord gave them some assurance that as they went on their mission to preach the good news of that kingdom, they would be sustained in a way that no human preparation could supply. The kingdom would not come at the behest of men, nor could it be prepared for by normal human means. But one of the ways that they could prepare for it would be by constantly calling to mind the sacrifice that the Lord had offered for them. So ended their Passover meal, and they sang a hymn. What thoughts would have been in their minds as that very intimate occasion came to an end? For a short time, they had enjoyed that haven of peace and profound instruction as Jesus took their understanding of the truth to a new level, both in doctrine and in practice. In just a few minutes, they would open the door so that the fulfillment of the next part of the Lord's ministry could take place. And it was not going to be a comfortable time for any of them. It's been suggested that they sang one of the Psalms at that stage as they went out from that room. And having sung it, this group, now consisting of the Lord and 11 men, made their way into the quietness and the darkness of the city to the seclusion of the Garden of Gethsemane. The rest of the chapter that we read this morning outlines the detail of what else took place as the trial and the crucifixion loomed closer. But now we need to look more closely on the other aspect, to look at the disciples, before we return to the Lord at the end. What was it about those men that Jesus had chosen them? The Bible is full of examples of men and women who have had a very significant part to play, despite their human backgrounds. Even people whose natural backgrounds would make them quite unsuitable for the work that they were later to carry out. And often, we read just a name once in the Bible, and that's all we know. And yet their names have been recorded in this book for us to just think about. Think of those members of the ecclesias that Paul mentioned by name, and we only have their name. Think of all those people listed meticulously in the Chronicles as we've been reading in the last few days. The same applies to us. Why have we been called? So that ultimately we may have our names recorded in the Book of Life. We'll come back to the disciples. As I said earlier, in that upper room was the embryo of the Ecclesia of Christ, filled with men who had very little to distinguish them from so many people around them. But by them, the truth would be preached. And some of them would fulfill the work of evangelizing the world, not just by travels and witnessing, but by their writings. And the abiding lesson that Jesus taught them in that upper room before that work began was not the hierarchy that they would need to establish to take the work forward, not the organization, not the structure, not the positions of honour and responsibility or any of those things. Jesus said, "But ye shall not be so. But he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he that is chief, as he that doth serve." And that's what Jesus demonstrated when he took a bowl and a towel and washed their feet. And as a brother has written, the lesson of the washing of the feet in the upper room is that each saint should be prepared to serve the Lord Jesus and his or her brethren and sisters in the humblest of roles, not seeking to have the preeminence, but ready according to each other's gifts and circumstances to shoulder the responsibilities of the truth after the example of Christ himself. I think we can dwell on that point for exhortation. Surely Jesus meant the disciples to do some self-examination and to think for themselves what this might mean for them, and we can do exactly the same. Truly, we need to be prepared to fulfill every task that needs to be done and to regard others as better than ourselves. But saying that we will do it is not necessarily the same as actually doing it. We need to seek out those opportunities for foot washing and then take down the bowl and the towel and actually do it. Every task that we may be called upon to fulfil, or that we feel we should volunteer to do, is an act of foot washing. And if the bowl and the towel remain on the shelf unused, then it is equivalent to hiding the light under a bushel or burying the talent in the ground. And that's the exhortation the disciples received at the first breaking of bread. It's an exhortation that might help us as we consider what we can do for the truth, indeed for our ecclesia, over the coming months, if Christ remains away, as we think about the wider needs that there are to be fulfilled. And then another kind of self-examination came to their attention. They would have been shocked when Jesus then went on to say, "Verily I say unto you, one of you shall betray me." So they instantly sought clarification of that allegation. And they asked, "Is it I?" None of them wanted to be tarred with that brush. And the identity of the betrayer was not long coming when Judas got up and left the room. But it didn't end there. As Peter protested that he would never forsake his master, let alone betray him, Jesus said, "I tell thee, Peter, the cock shall not crow this day before that thou shalt thrice deny that thou knowest me." It was not a remark that would have left Peter feeling good about himself, but he needed to hear it. And we know that Peter did deny Jesus when the pressure was on, and the cock did crow. But Jesus had also assured Peter, and this perhaps is the most important bit, that "I have prayed for thee that thy faith fail not." Yes, there will be times when we find we have done the opposite to that which we intended. We will fall short, and we will make mistakes, and when the pressure is on, we will do the opposite of what we wanted. But we're in good company, because many servants of God did this. Moses, David, Paul, and various others have let the side down. And imagine if our personal failings were written down for the world to read as theirs were. But the important thing is that Jesus assured Peter and assures us that he had prayed for him, that his faith fail not. So if we ever have that question to ask in incredulity, "Is it I?" then may we not be like Judas, but be like Peter. Because Peter repented, and Peter had much to think about as he picked himself up and carried on. Peter was certain that he could lay down his life for Jesus. When it came to it, he was certainly not up to that. He was still at the stage where he would seize a sword to defend Jesus. And that wasn't right either. We here in this latter day upper room, assembled around these same simple emblems of bread and wine, are still learning what the disciples learnt, and we are still benefiting from the Lord's promise. All those centuries later, we celebrate the price that has been paid for our redemption, and we're learning the lessons of humility and self-examination that will help each of us on our journey to that same kingdom. So may we ultimately, brethren and sisters, be found worthy of what Jesus has done for all of us.
We thought of Jesus' work and his death. Let's also now remember his resurrection in the singing of hymn 79. Sing praise, the tomb is void where the Redeemer lay. Sing of our bonds destroyed, our darkness turned to day. Weep for your dead no more. Friends, be of joyful cheer. Our star moves on before, our narrow path shines clear. Hymn 79. Would Brother Brian Morslover please close our meeting with prayer after we've sung hymn 269. Hymn 269. Oft in danger, oft in woe, onward, brethren, onward go. Fight the fight, maintain the strife, strengthened with the bread of life. Hymn 269.